winter of 1994, Damien Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly were all convicted of the murders of Christopher Byers, Stevie Branch, and Michael Moore. It's been a long, slow process over the last several months, breaking down and analyzing both the investigation, the trials, and the convictions of the so-called West Memphis Three. As mentioned last week, my intention before we take our mid-season break is to give you as much first-hand, inside information as to what was going on during the trials. Last week, we heard from Jason Baldwin himself, and this week, we're going to get a little better perspective on the conviction of Jesse Lloyd Miskelly Jr. Jesse's attorney, Dan Stidham, has agreed to come on the show and walk us through his first-hand account of defending Jesse Miskelly. And now, without any further ado, here is now sitting judge, Dan Stidham.
First of all, let me say how grateful I am to be with you this afternoon and participating in this podcast. My name is Dan Stidham. I represented Jesse Miskelly in one of the most infamous crimes to ever take place in the United States, the West Memphis murder case back on May 5th or May 6th, depending on how you want to approach that and the time of death in 1993. I was the only attorney who worked on the case from beginning to end, so I sort of have a very unique context for that I bring to the case. To me, the case did not end with the Alford plea in 2011. I've continued to work on the case, trying to find who's really responsible for these horrible crimes, and also I've been working faithfully on my memoirs of the case, a book that I've started many years ago. But that's what I've been doing, is chasing killers and writing books. I think the Alford book, hard to believe it's been 25 years. And the case continues to evolve in many ways. So I've learned that writing books is about like trying to get people out of prison. It's a long, long game of chess, and you have to plan your moves ahead of time. That's what I've been doing.
Great. And am I right, Dan, are you a judge now?
I am. I'm the state district judge for the 17th Judicial District of Arkansas, which right now is comprised of Greene County in the northeast corner of the state, about 80 miles north of West Memphis and about 4 hours south of St. Louis.
All right, well, let's jump right into your involvement in the West Memphis 3 case, because you are unique in being that, because you were still representing Jesse Miskelly all the way through the Alford plea, correct?
Well, towards the end, starting in 2008, my role in the case switched dramatically from being an attorney involved in every aspect of day-to-day participation with the defense team, which included a tremendous lineup of fantastic lawyers, to that of being a witness in the case. The Rule 37 hearings started in 2008 and continued over into 2009. And since I was a witness in those hearings and proceedings, I could no longer be both an attorney and a witness at the same time. So I was kind of taken out, and that was a struggle for me because I've been involved for so long. But my being a witness was far more important than my being a lawyer there towards the end of the case.
And I guess that's a good first question to ask you is, what was it about Jesse's case that drove you to stay involved for as long as you did?
Well, the sheer injustice of it all. And I was a very young attorney. I had just turned 30 years old when I was assigned the case. I was the only attorney who didn't seek out the case. All the other attorneys ran to West Memphis and said, pick me, pick me. And I wasn't. I just got a phone call out of the blue. In fact, this entire case has been a series of phone calls out of the blue. But that particular phone call took place in early June, a couple of days after Miss Kelly's so-called confession. And a circuit judge who was from Perryville, my hometown, was on the bench that day, and it was his task to appoint lawyers, and he thought of me. And, of course, that's why I went to law school, is to represent people who need help in criminal defense. Everybody's entitled to a defense. And even though at that particular moment in time, I assumed that he was guilty because of the confession, I was torn between wanting to get involved and thinking this is crazy and no, I don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, so to speak. And so I went to my ex-wife, assuming that she would talk me out of it. And, unfortunately or fortunately, I would look at it. She said, hey, this is why you went to law school. This is your kind of thing. Do it. And so I called the judge back and said, I'm in. So that's how it all got started. That was the genesis.
Now, you'd said that at the beginning you thought that Jesse was guilty, and one of the first things I wanted to ask you was, you know, reading all of the transcripts of all the statements Jesse's given, he gave one to you in August, you know, that summer, a couple months after he had confessed, and my take on that, it looked like you were discussing possible plea bargains with Jesse. At that point, you were kind of repeating back to him what he had said in his confession. At that point, did you still think that he was probably guilty?
Yes, I had what I've always referred to as an epiphany, but it didn't come until September of 93. And it finally hit me one day, just like someone hit me in the head with a 2x4, that, hey, now I get it. Now I understand what's going on. And everything changed from that moment on. And with the help of Ron Lax, who was a very talented and great guy, offered to do some private investigative work for us. He had an office in Memphis, Tennessee, and Nashville. And he hooked me up with Dr. Richard Offshay. And I began to learn what a false confession was and how it happens and why it happens. And at that time, there were probably 4 or 5, maybe 6 or 7 people on the planet who actually understood the dynamics of a false confession, how they happen, why they happen, and what you can do to prevent that. And in September and October and December of 1993, as we moved closer to trial, I became the 7th person to understand the dynamics. And the task became, how do I explain this to the jury when it's so hard to grasp already? I had a background in psychology and sociology from college, so it was easier for me than it might be for a layperson to understand. But we lost a lot of time that we should have been preparing, and so it set us back tremendously.
So in September, you said you had that epiphany moment, and you realized that it was a false confession. Up to that point, had you even really asked Jesse if he'd done it or not? Or how did that conversation happen when you finally decided we're going to go ahead and plead not guilty and fight this?
Well, Jesse and Ms. Kelly is intellectually challenged. Most people don't disagree about that, but there are still a few folks out there, a small minority, who believe that Jesse is not mentally challenged. But he is. That's the truth. The truth of the matter was, he's intellectually challenged. Back in 1993, we referred to that as mental retardation. In today's world, it's intellectually challenged, is the phrase. And Jesse Miss Kelly was essentially a 5-year-old child. That was the level of his IQ. That was the level of his intellectual capabilities, and that made him the perfect patsy for the West Memphis police to lead down this crazy story that they believed. Jesse Miss Kelly didn't confess on that day. Gary Gitchell and Brian Ridge confessed. They put everything into his mouth, and he simply pared it back with one thing in mind. That was just tell them what they want to hear so I can go home. And that's what led to it. What led to the epiphany was I had gotten a phone call in August from John Fogelman stating that they had found some DNA on a white T-shirt in Mr. Miss Kelly's trailer and in the trailer park, and it was a perfect match to one of the 3 victims. And so that you know, that to me was the icing on the cake. I, of course, filed a motion to have it tested independently, but suddenly in September, at a pretrial hearing, Baldwin walked up to me and said, oh, by the way, that's not, the DNA is not one of the victims. It was your client's blood. And so just like a light bulb went off in my head, and I drove to the jail the next day where Jesse was being held. And instead of interrogating him like I had been doing for the past several months, I just asked him, you know, to tell me why there was blood on a T-shirt found in his trailer. And for the first time, Jesse Misko told me something about what he knew. He actually knew, instead of trying to make up something to please me. And he told me, that's my blood. I throw soda bottles up in the air and break with my fist when I get angry at people. And I wiped the blood on my T-shirt. And it was just, everything changed at that moment. Everything changed. So we began buckling down and getting ready for trial. Because, as I later learned, Jesse actually considered me to be one of the West Memphis police officers. And so every time I'd go talk to him about the case, he would tell me a different version of the story. And he couldn't remember the story because he didn't have all the props that the West Memphis police were using, the photographs of the victims, which I think is extremely cruel. Didn't have newspaper articles where pictures of the victims were in the newspaper and underneath it said the victim Byers, the victim Moore, the victim Branch. And if you listen to Mr. Miskelly's confession, you can hear him referring to the victims as the Branch and the Moore and the Byers because he's just trying to please his interrogators.
At what point did he finally tell you that he didn't actually do it?
It was in September of 93. And people with intellectual disabilities, there's two types. There's people who suffer from mental illness, and fortunately, modern medicine provides some measure of hope for folks with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, and with medication, they can lead a somewhat normal life. But for someone who's intellectually challenged, there is no cure. They're not going to get better. They're only going to stay the same. And so Jesse Miskelly today is 10 years older than I was when I tried this case, and he's still the same 5-year-old kid that he was 25 years ago. There's no cure for that. And people like Jesse Miskelly, especially when he was 17, he's a little wiser now because of all the bad things that have happened to him. When he tries to mask his disability, you know, people like Jesse Miskelly are more likely to doubt their own experiences, the things that they've witnessed, the things that they've seen. And people who are normal and can think abstractly, they don't have that issue. But Mr. Miskelly, and it took me years to understand this, and not until it's post-conviction, when Dr. Tim Dunning from California, he was an excellent forensic psychologist, he explained to me that Jesse is very, very good at masking his disability. And he calls it cheating to lose. People with mental and intellectual disabilities, they cheat their disability so that they don't appear to be disabled. And they just pretty much go along with whatever an authority figure says. And when you're 17 and you've got a mental intellectual disability, then you're especially malleable to being led through the sort of false confession that exactly what happened in West Memphis. And by the way, I listened to your podcast a couple of weeks ago on my way back from my daughter's law school graduation in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And I listened to, I guess it was episode, let me say 525. Does that sound right? About the confession?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And I listened to it again last night, 525. And I must say that your analysis and the step-by-step explanation of how these words didn't come from Jesse Miskelly, they came from Gitchell and Ridge, I thought that's one of the best analyses that I've ever listened to or read. So you did an excellent job in sorting through that. I applaud you.
No, I appreciate that. you know, when we broke it down that way and really took it piece by piece, in my opinion, it became pretty painfully obvious that Jesse didn't demonstrate any kind of knowledge of this crime whatsoever throughout any of the different confessions. And of course, that's the people that still believe that it was a legitimate conviction and that the three are guilty. You know, they always cite Jesse, or why would he confess over and over and over again? And you were there for a lot of those. And one of the big ones was after he was convicted and he came back with and he supposedly confessed to the police officers in the car. Then you sat down and did the Bible confession with him, where he put his hand on the Bible. Can you kind of walk us through that experience and what you were thinking when it was going on?
Yeah, that was, you know, that's one of the things that a lot of people, and as you know, there's a wide following with regard to the West Memphis case and various chat rooms and podcasts and things of that nature. And there's lots of people, I say lots, I think they're a small majority, but they want to hang their hats on this Bible confession. They have no idea what the circumstances were. So I'd like to enlighten your listeners a little bit in that regard. When Jesse left the courthouse that day to be transported to prison, my instructions were to him to not say anything to these officers about anything that's to do with the case. And number two, I admonished the officers, both of them, Clay County deputy, that they were under no circumstances to talk to my client. And of course, they did the exact opposite. And I've always suspected, though I can't prove it, that they were instructed by the prosecution to do just that. And so Jesse, being Jesse, will tell you pretty much whatever you want to hear. And so the officers begin to explain to him that he's the only one that's going to go to prison. The other two are going to get off if you don't testify against them. That he was going to die in prison, and that I didn't care about him, that he couldn't trust me. And it's just so easy to get him to say whatever he wants to say. So that particular day, I went down to the prison with Fogelman and Davis, who were both very, very eager to have his testimony in the second trial, which was coming up in just a couple weeks. And for your listeners, and you may remember this as well, there's a scene in Paradise Lost where Fogelman and Davis are meeting with the victim's parents at Brent Davis's office in Jonesboro, mm-hmm. and he's explaining to them that they need Jesse Miskelly really bad. And without him, I believe the phrase Brent Davis used was, we may have a 50-50 shot. It may have been Fogelman that said that. So they were desperate to get his testimony. And so I sat down with Jesse. And of course, he was all worked up. He didn't want to be in prison anymore. He was told that this was his only way out, was to testify. So if you take the time to read the so-called Bible confession, you'll see that by the end of the tape, when Jesse's confronted with actually having to go into the courtroom and testify under oath, he suddenly decides that he didn't do that anymore. And that is one of the things that Dr. Durning described. People with intellectual disabilities don't understand the rules. They don't understand how court works. Most of them, the studies have shown, believe they can't lie in court. So he was faced with that problem. I want to get out of here. I want to do what they want me to do so I can go home. That was his sole purpose throughout the entire process. What do I have to tell you? What do I have to make up? What do I have to parrot back to you just so I can go home? But when it came right down to it, he didn't want to tell any more lies about Jason and Jesse. And I think he felt bad that he had pulled them into this horrible situation. But for the background, when I got there and started talking to Jesse, I went back out in the hall and I asked the prosecutors for two things. I said, I need a Bible and I need a crime scene map with all the places where the bodies were discovered whited out. So I just have nothing but a blank map of the crime scene. So they bring me both. So and it's been a while since I've looked at the transcript for the Bible confession, but basically what I'm doing is asking Jesse to show me where everything happened. And he gets it all wrong. He says the bodies were thrown in where the big pipe goes across the bayou, and that he didn't get in the water because it was over his head. The water was deep, and of course, the real facts are the kids were found upstream, if you will, in a smaller creek that fed into the bayou. And as you look at the pictures of the officers recovering the body, they're standing about knee-deep water, maybe a little higher than that. But it became clear to me that Jesse didn't know anything about what happened that day. He was merely, his story would change based on the testimony he heard in the courtroom or what his new interrogator would be telling him to say. And that sensed it for me. And I asked him, all right, if you were there and this really happened, give me something that I can prove it with. And he brought up this whiskey bottle issue. And so he said, I broke a whiskey bottle under an overpass there on Interstate I-55 and I-40. And this is where a lot of nines start hanging their hat again, is we prosecutors and I and Gary Gitchell got a flashlight and we went to the overpass and started looking for whiskey bottles. And we not only found one whiskey bottle, we found thousands of whiskey bottles. I mean, they were everywhere, just littered everywhere. We actually rousted a homeless person who was sleeping under the overpass. And so that didn't corroborate anything for me. In fact, it just strengthened the idea that there's no way to corroborate this crazy story that Jesse Mitzkelly told. And as you pointed out in one of the subsequent podcasts that I listened to, I think you very astutely pointed out that this is not a series of confessions. It's all the same, just different variations of the false narrative.
Right.
And that's exactly what it is. But there's a quote, and I probably will get it wrong, but it's one of my favorite quotes. And for those who believe, no explanation is necessary, and to those who don't, no explanation is possible. And that's kind of how things go down. Mm-hmm. People want to either look at the facts and interpret the facts correctly, or they want to look at something they can't understand. And, when I speak all around the country, and one of the slides in my PowerPoint is a slide about that old Stevie Wonder song, Superstition. One of the lyrics in the song is, when you believe in things that you don't understand, it creates problems. It's superstition. And that's what happened in this case. Everybody jumped to this conclusion that this was a satanic ritual and nothing could be further from the truth. There's never been a satanic ritual ever documented on the planet, ever. And the FBI has tried to do it in an exhaustive study. The study's been replicated in the UK, and there's just no such thing as satanic ritualistic homicide.
One thing that I really noticed when he did the so-called Bible confession with you is the first part, when you actually sat back and let him narrate his day and talk through his day, he began his air quote confession by describing the interaction with the police at the trailer park that night that happened between 6:30 and 7 p.m. And that part he gave pretty vivid detail. I mean, I took some flack for it from the nons, the people that think they're guilty. But to me, that confession with you seemed to alibi him more than anything else, because that's the only thing where he gave vivid detail was that interaction with the police.
That police officer who encountered Jesse Mitzkelly in the trailer park that night at 6:30 committed perjury on the witness stand. He was there, and people saw him there, and people saw him talking with Jesse at the squad car. But he swore under oath that he never saw Jesse Mitzkelly the whole time he was there investigating the call that he'd received. And that's the kind of thing you see throughout the entire case, is everyone from the police to the prosecution to the judge was willing at every twist and turn to do whatever it was necessary to preserve this regime of truth that they had adopted. And it didn't matter that the facts didn't match up. It didn't matter that, it was apparent to anyone who would look at the evidence that this is not what happened. It couldn't have happened that way. But I hesitate to use the analogy of a lynching, but it really was that kind of mentality. I mean, people wanted this wrapped up in a nice, neat package, and these three kids to get the death penalty. And that's what they wanted, and there was this fervor that was created. And being a young, naive criminal defense lawyer, who I might add, as many people know, was marching slowly towards my first jury trial as first chair, it was pretty overwhelming. But I was able to get two of the most respected and leading experts in police interrogation techniques and in false confessions. But Judge Burnett limited their testimony so much that it kept us from being able to pull out a victory at trial.
And that's the thing that I wanted to talk to you about next, is the challenges you had with Judge Burnett's rulings before and during the trial, limiting what you could talk. So if you could talk a little bit about the challenges that you had going into this trial, other than being, as you said, very green. It's what you said, it was your first jury trial sitting first chair?
Yes. I had worked on several murder cases, including a capital murder case while I was in law school. I was a law clerk for W.H. Taylor, a well-known lawyer in Northwest Arkansas. He was not quite as young as I was when I was involved in this guy case, but he was a young lawyer as well, and I learned more about practicing law from him than I ever did in law school. But I got to work on quite a few high-profile cases, and one involving the death penalty, so I had a lot of hands-on experience, and he taught me how to pick a jury by looking at the potential jurors' bumper stickers. These days, lawyers do it on Facebook. You can tell more about someone on their Facebook page than you can from a bumper sticker. So it's kind of made the process easier when you're picking a jury. But I had some experience, but this was my first jury trial. Burnett, as a former prosecutor, never really loosened that role, I guess would be a good way to describe it, after he took the bench. And at the time, it wasn't so obvious to me, but looking back as an older lawyer now, looking back at my younger self, I realized that it's very, very clear, especially when you go back and look at the raw footage of the trials, that Burnett was part of the prosecution team. And it's very, very clear now looking back. And to give you an example, I was trying to introduce a police report during the trial. And, of course, they're inadmissible. It's hearsay. And to my huge surprise, neither Fogelman or Brent Davis objected. And so I started to exhibit this to the jury. And the point of it was is they were trying to establish that Jesse Miskelly knew things that only someone who was there could have known. And I'm introducing a police report where it definitely showed that all this was out in the community. Everybody knew about it. So when the prosecutors didn't object, I was starting to walk over to the jury to hand them the document, the exhibit. Judge Burnett stopped me and said, "Are you sure you guys don't want to object to this? It's hearsay." And I said, "No, Your Honor, they said they had no objection." And he said, "Are you sure you don't want to object to this?" So finally he relented, and I actually got to show it to the jury. But that's what I faced throughout the entire process. I've always told people that the only two motions that I won during the entire trial was the change of venue, which was obviously a slam dunk. And the other one was I asked to go to lunch early during the trial, which he granted. And those are the only two motions that I can recall having any success on.
Right. And then, so in one big one that I noticed, I mean, I noticed a lot, obviously, but what really stuck out to me was what you had mentioned earlier, Burnett's ruling about limiting the testimony of your experts. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that went down?
You know, Jesse Miskelly had never gotten the best of anything out of life his first 17 years, and I was determined to change that. And so I went out as a young, inexperienced lawyer, and somehow I convinced these two guys to come in, even though I couldn't pay them. They both read the confession and all the officer's notes, all the documentation that I had in my file, and they immediately said, "Oh my God, this kid is innocent. I'm coming out to help." And I said, well, I can't pay you. All I can do is ask the court to reimburse you after the trial's over. And they both said, we don't care. This kid's innocent and we're coming out. And there were other experts that I was not successful in obtaining. I tried to get Park Dietz, a friendly psychologist, to come in. I couldn't get past the secretary without a $15,000 up front, which, of course, I didn't have. But these two guys came in on their own dime, and I hadn't heard the testimony in a long time, but I was listening to the podcast last night, and I think it was the follow-up to the one we were discussing earlier, I guess 525A. And at the end of the podcast, you actually played the tape, which I assume is from one of the HBO films, where Warren Holmes is testifying. And any time I got close to scoring points with Mr. Holmes, the prosecutors would stand up. And last night when I was listening to it, Brent Davis stood up and objected because I asked Mr. Holmes to describe the characteristics of someone who's prone to give a false confession. And their objection was Mr. Holmes was not a psychologist. And, of course, that's not a proper objection. And so Burnett says, are you objecting on the basis of lack of foundation? And, of course, Davis says yes. And, of course, then he shut me down. It was very frustrating. I don't know if you can sense the frustration in my voice as I asked to approach the bench, but there were numerous occasions where it would take place like that. And ultimately, with Mr. Holmes, I got in most of what I needed, except for the polygraph, of course. And I argued unsuccessfully that should have been admitted. If the police are going to use a polygraph to trick someone into giving a false confession, the jury ought to be entitled to have that information, especially when you have perhaps the most qualified expert in the world on polygraph sitting there under oath testifying that he passed the polygraph. The only question he was showed any deceit on was, have you ever done drugs? That was powerful testimony, and Burnett knew if that got in, it would win. And I do believe, even to this day, that had Offshay been allowed to testify, and had Holmes been allowed to testify, we would have gotten an acquittal. And I can base that on some facts. There was a lot of things that went on during the deliberations that came out later on that made it very clear that we were very close to convincing the jury that Mr. Mitch Kelly gave a false confession.
Yeah.
One of the things that happened, and I didn't mean to interrupt, I apologize, but we did a proffer and proffered, you know, what Mr. Holmes would have testified to if the judge would have allowed it. And we did a proffer into the record of what Dr. Offshay would have testified to, but the jury wasn't in the courtroom. They had been taken out to the jury room. And after the proffers were given, we took a recess, and people started walking up to me in the courtroom, reporters, spectators, and they were all going, oh, my gosh, you're going to win this case. And I said, well, the jury wasn't in here to hear that. You heard it, but they didn't. And the jury's only as good as the information it's allowed to hear. And so it was very, very, very frustrating. And so my strategy became, you know, I could see the train coming down the tracks. I always thought at every step of the case that I had a chance to win. I really did. And looking back now, 25 years later, I realized that the train was coming down the tracks and it was going to take me a while to derail it. But I started setting little traps that I thought maybe an appellate court might grasp in order to fix this problem. And that's just, it became an 18-year, 78-day game of chess that ultimately I was able to win. And I'm not trying to suggest even for a second that it's I who won this case. There are lots of people who came forward, and but for them, they'd still be in prison today. And the list is long. And every time you start naming names, you're always prone to forget someone who was important, but taking that risk, you know, people like Eddie Vedder, for example, who really got this case moving when it had stalled out. Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings fame, who did West of Memphis, along with Fran Walsh, his partner, who just is one of the nicest people I've ever encountered. I, really loved spending what little time I could with her when the movie was screened at Sundance. Winona Ryder, John Phillipsborn, who was the chief architect of the legal team, the defense team, just an amazing lawyer. I've never encountered a lawyer. He's got gears that I never thought about even having. He's that amazing. The list goes on and on. But how could I forget Joe Berlinger and Bruce Chernofsky? Without them, none of the others would have been possible. Eddie Vedder would have never seen the films, would have never been pushed to get involved in the case. And so the HBO films and my good friends Joe Berlinger and Bruce Chernofsky, unfortunately now passed. Without them, we would have never gotten them out of prison.
Can you touch on specifically, and I think I recall from the transcripts, but what did the judge hear in the proffer that the jury didn't hear regarding Holmes and Offshay? What part of their testimony was not allowed to be presented because of Burnett's ruling?
Well, Holmes was not allowed, as the podcast pointed out that I listened to last night, the follow-up to the confession podcast. He shut Holmes down immediately about the characteristics of someone who would give a false confession, and of course that would be someone of low intelligence, low intellect, intellectually challenged, someone who's young, basically the template of Jesse Miskelley. Of course, he also was not allowed to testify about the polygraph, which are absolutely important, and I thought I had provided some good cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, one of which was an Arkansas case that says anything that suggests that the defendant is innocent should be allowed in court, even though the scientific reliability of it may not be as up to snuff as would be expected. If the police can use this to prove that you're guilty or to coerce you into giving a confession, then why shouldn't you be allowed to provide evidence to the contrary? And I still think that's terrible. If they're not going to let people who are defending themselves in court use the polygraph, they shouldn't let people use the polygraph, let police use the polygraph. And I've seen some crazy stuff over the years from people using this voice synthesizer nonsense where they can tell you that you're lying because your voice synthesizer pattern on the laptop is telling them that you're lying. And that craziness to actually have them put their hand on a copy machine and take a copy of their hand and then look at the hand and say, yep, you're lying. Just a new little trick that they want to use. So, I mean, it's just, and the Reid technique of interrogations, which is still widely used, is the worst thing that ever happened with regard to police interrogation tactics. It creates false confessions just by its very nature. And I've been struggling to get the Reid technique abolished for the last 25 years, and people are starting to come around and realize that it's a problem, but it's one of the chief problems. But getting back to Offshay's testimony, he was not allowed to tell the jury that, in his opinion, Ms. Kelly's statement was involuntary and coerced, and thus a false confession. He was never allowed to give his conclusions about the case, which were absolutely essential to our defense. Had he been allowed, or had the jury been allowed to hear his testimony unfettered, which was admissible by all standards at the time, I think the jury result would have been different. I think we would have gotten an acquittal. I know there's a lot of people out there who think I'm deranged for making that bold statement, but I can actually back it up with some facts. That was crucial, and of course Burnett knew that, and that's why I didn't let it come in. And I found it extremely ironic that a self-proclaimed satanic expert, a retired police officer, I believe it was from Ohio, who had a mail-order PhD, he was qualified as an expert to testify about occult, ritual, satanic killings. And Judge Burnett said from the bench that even a third grader who has specialized knowledge about issues before a jury can be qualified as an expert, and he qualified Dale Griffiths as an expert on satanic crimes, where in my trial, I had a Pulitzer Prize-winning social psychologist from a little-known university out west called UC Berkeley who wasn't qualified as an expert. So I find it so ironic that Judge Burnett was willing and let in anything that would help the prosecution but keep out anything that might cause problems for the prosecutors. It's all there on video for everybody to see.
Right. And wasn't part of his reasoning or the entirety of his reasoning that he gave for not allowing Afshay give his actual conclusion was because he said Judge Burnett had said that the testimony or the statement was credible, and so he wouldn't allow an expert to come in and say that it wasn't credible.
That's the logic that he used, but that's not the law.
Right.
The law says that the judge decides whether to suppress the statement or not, and he ruled that the statement was coming in, which of course was no surprise to us. But that doesn't mean you can't attack the confession and the circumstances in which it was obtained, and that's part of the state's proving their case beyond a reasonable doubt. It didn't say, his ruling didn't say we couldn't attack the confession, and by using experts who are qualified, chip away at how the confession was obtained, whether or not it was a false confession, whether it was Gitchell's confession and Ridge's confession, or whether it was Jesse Mischel's confession. And so I just don't believe that was the correct interpretation of the law. And unfortunately, the Arkansas Supreme Court didn't agree with my argument in that regard.
Okay, and the last thing that I want to ask you about this case is just kind of summarily, you've made it crystal clear that you have always believed in Jesse Mischel's innocence, and you fought for him at trial after trial. How do you think that this case has shaped you in the rest of your career, both as an attorney and now as a judge?
Well, that's a good question. And for many years, I was never willing to kind of talk about that kind of stuff because it's painful to relive some of the things that happened over the course of the last 25 years. And my marriage didn't emerge through this. My kids suffered for it. Bad things have happened to me, threats on my life, things of that nature. But I was asked that very same question in April 2014. I agreed to speak at the Baltimore Public Schools. I was invited out there by a teacher who's an amazing teacher. His name is Joel Brucewitz at Catonsville High School. And a 16-year-old high school student asked me that question, how has this case affected you? And it stunned me because you're now the second person who's asked me that question. But I didn't know what to say because I've just never been asked that question, nor had I been willing to talk about it. And so that's sort of what my book is about. I'm kind of opening myself up, and I talk about the struggles. The book is not so much a retelling of the West Memphis case because everybody knows what happened, and as far as what occurred during the trials and the Alford plea and how that happened. And actually, a lot of people don't understand how that happened. That's one of the goals of my book, is to explain that. But that 16-year-old high school student brought me to my knees, so to speak. And over the course of the next couple of months, I began to realize how important it was to share that aspect. So this book is, I don't want to sound spooky like Aaron Hutchison spooky, but nobody really knows what happened to me because I was there every day while this case was going on. And so it's sort of like the movie Titanic, which, you know, was a great film, but some people were reluctant to go into the theater to see it because a boat sank. I mean, you know that there's going to be a boat sinking. And or the movie Lincoln, you know, a lot of people didn't want to go see that because the president gets shot. You know, we get shot and it changes the course of history. But what both films have done is they have laid a background story, what was going on in the background that people don't really know anything about. Now, part of that is what happened to me. Part of that is the misconduct of people who are involved in the case. And the fact that they were never brought to atone for those sins, the Alford plea took that away. The Alfred plea also kept the West Memphis 3 from being compensated for their wrongful incarceration and wrongful convictions. That also robbed me of a lot of redemption that my soul desperately needed. I'd always imagined myself walking into the Coliseum like Russell Crowe and the Gladiator, and I was going to smite my enemies and walk around with their heads on my sword and win this case at trial and win it outright. And that's what would have happened. And I really, really believe had we gotten a new trial. And that's why, of course, the offer plea took place. But the first draft of the book, by the time I hired, Tom was not new to the case, Tom McCarthy, that my co-author, that I just signed the, or we're working out the final details, but we've agreed in principle for him to come on as a co-author. The first draft, I was so bitter and angry because I was still bitter and angry about all the things that happened. In fact, one of the persons who was involved in the case, a colleague, commented on one of the chapters I sent him about his particular role. He said, "Dan, why are you so angry?" And I didn't realize it that I was so angry. But now looking back, I'm glad this process has evolved because I'm not as angry as I used to be. And there's a few reasons for that. But I think people who ultimately do decide that they want to know the whole story, they want to hear the truth, if they do go buy the book, and I hope they do, and we hope to have it done next year and published next year, I think they'll be very interested in knowing what really happened, because there's a lot of things that people have never heard that I'll be discussing in the book, and I hope maybe you'll have me back on after the book is published so that we can discuss those things. My contracts keep me from being able to talk about those things at this very moment, but there's going to be a lot of things that are told that have never been told before about this case that people will be talking about 300 years from now, just like we talk about the Salem Witch Trials. The Arkansas Witch Trials, it's something that hasn't lost its luster. People are still talking about this. And those kids in Baltimore weren't even born yet in 1993. And they're just as excited and interested in this case and the outcome. And what they see plainly as a wrongful conviction, that some people who were there and actually saw it happen still can't wrap their minds around the facts, the true facts.
The students you're talking about in Baltimore, is that some of the pro bono work that you do?
Well, I talk about the case. I travel. People invite me to speak. I speak on college campuses, law schools, professional organizations. And I've always kind of hesitated to do high schools because of the nature of the crimes are just so horrifying that it's hard to talk to them. You know, when I speak to professional organizations and adults, you know, I use the graphic photos to illustrate points, and I also don't feel comfortable doing that in front of high school students. So, but these students are so excited and thrilled at this case. Joel Bruchowitz, their teacher, keeps inviting me back year after year. I've been 6 times in 4 years. In fact, I just made a visit this past April, a couple months ago, and it's always exciting. And the questions that these kids are really kind of intimidating because they just break it down. And I don't know if that's because they're kids, but they're really excited. And I have a tremendous faith in the future of our world. And some days you wake up and watch the news and there's not a whole lot to be encouraged by. But these kids, the future prosecutors, future lawyers, defense lawyers, judges, police officers, if I can have impact on one of them, it's worth the effort, and I enjoy it so much. People have been asking me ever since the HBO films came out from time to time to look into cases involving their relatives, their sons, their daughters. You know, I don't proclaim to be an expert in anything but my unique experience in this case, but because of all the work I've done, I've become what I refer to, I guess, as a quasi-expert in a lot of things forensic. I know who to refer people to. I've met a lot of interesting people and got to work with some amazing forensic pathologists and other experts. So I can't practice law because I'm a full-time judge, but I can evaluate cases most of the time, I can come to the conclusion that they're guilty and I don't want to get interested in something like that. But occasionally I'll find someone that got a raw deal, just like the West Memphis 3 did. And so I'm eager to help, and it's pro bono. I don't charge a fee. I can't charge a fee. And I wouldn't even if I could, because what Offshane Holmes did for me, they flew to Arkansas on their own dime to help a kid named Jesse Miskelly, and they saved his life. And so it's hard for me to say no. Sometimes I'm reviewing a case right now from South Carolina that I've been working on for some time, but life is challenging, and sometimes we get distracted, and so I've been working on it longer than I really would like. But, one thing I've learned about this case in life is that we don't get to choose the things that happen to us, but we do get to choose how we respond to them. And we can tuck our tail and run and hide and try not to think about things that are horrifying. And we can dust ourselves off and pick ourselves up and keep moving forward and playing the game of chess. And that's kind of how I approach life. And that's certainly how I approach my work in the West Memphis case. And I'm still looking for the killer. And I hope I find him. And the sooner the better.
Hopefully all of you enjoyed the interview and also got something out of hearing the firsthand information directly from Dan. I've personally admired Dan Sidham for a long time because of his continued support and representation of Jesse Miskelly, even though he wasn't getting paid throughout the trial and it took years for him to get a fraction of what he was owed from the state. Nonetheless, Dan has always stood by Jesse's side. Continuing with our theme of getting first-hand information from the people involved in this case before we take our mid-season break, next week we're going to move on to our third defendant with an interview with Damian Eccles. Next week on Truth and Justice. Truth and Justice is a production of NBI Studios. Michael Bussing is your executive producer, and Shane Yoder is our sound engineer. All music for the show was created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. And Shane Yoder of PutThemInASong.com designed and created our Season 5 logo. A special thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website. And also a big thank you to our transcription team, Sarah Mueller, Anna Dindorf, Britta Bliss, and Stephanie McConnell. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $1 a month. And we also have reward levels on the Patreon page that include access to the behind-the-scenes videos of the taping of our Friday follow-up episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. But the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can follow along on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on the case. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.